Today, a little personal. How a call to ministry became a life in higher education.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So I think I have no idea why this is, but I mean, and I don't mean to turn this introspectively today. That is not where this is going. It's not a navel gazing exercise, as I've heard people describe it before. But I am using my own experience, my personal experience, to relate something of value that I think is real for all of us. And so I'm going all the way back, you know, to the beginning for me, in terms of my understanding the world around me and what I was going to do in it, to say, I don't know why this is, but there is something in me that has always wanted to not just communicate, not just stand up and say things to people, but teach, do something to help people understand something that they didn't understand before. I don't know why that is. There's just something that makes me want to do it. Whether I do it well or not, whether I've ever done it successfully or not, that's all a side point. The reality is it seems really important to me. It's a priority to me. And I can remember even when, and I've conveyed this in other episodes before, so I won't dwell on it, but I do want to reiterate my own calling, an important part of my life. And again, I can't say with authority where this came from or how it happened. I just know this is a reality of what happened with me, that I had a sense when I was young, when I was 13, but ignored it. But when I was 16, exactly the same thing again, a really clear awareness that I should be in ministry and that I should preach, that's what I was called to do. That's what God was calling me to do. And again, I can't prove that. I can't prove it was God who showed up and did that. But man, my best understanding is that's exactly what happened. And it was pretty immediate and direct. So you know, I'm lying in bed and I have a sense that I need to be a preacher. It's just like, yeah, you need to be a preacher. I don't want to be a preacher. And I've told you before, I've mentioned it in episodes before, that I really didn't want to be that. I had planned to be a lawyer, and my negotiation with God, not that I had done anything worthy of negotiating, like Abraham receiving God on the plains of Mamre, but can I plead for the 50 careers that I could have better than being a preacher? What if there are 40? What if there are just 10? Yeah, if there are 10, you can save one of those. And maybe that's true. Maybe God was like, if you could find even one career better than this one for you, I'd let you do it. But you really can't do anything, so come and help me. That's obviously the opposite of the case. I'm not helping God. But anyway, the point is, I knew that I was called to preach, and my negotiation was to say, look, if you don't want me to be a lawyer, okay, I'll be a teacher. Now, to me, that really wasn't any sacrifice at all, except for the money side. You know, I wouldn't make what lawyers make. That's how I was thinking of it. Great prosperity and wealth, and also a little glory, you know, in the courtroom, a little, you know, victory on the steps outside the courthouse may have been in my thinking about it, but whatever. I'll give all that up to be a teacher, you know, to stand in front of a room full of students who adore the things that I'm saying to them. So maybe that was a little bit selfish also, but it wasn't my calling. My calling wasn't just to teach something. My calling was to preach, to teach the things that are in Scripture. And that's the other half of this part about my calling that I wanted to make clear as I'm starting into this discussion today about, really about higher education. That's what I want to talk about. That the form that my vocation takes. So my job is in higher education. My job is in teaching in colleges. I mean, I've been doing it since the year 2000, even while I was still preaching, teaching as an adjunct professor and then as an associate professor and then a full professor and then so on. So my career has been in higher education for a long time, but my vocation, my calling is preaching. And so on Sundays, I'm preaching on, you know, at nights, a lot of times at a church or somewhere else preaching or teaching something that they need done there. I do consulting with churches because the experience I've had preaching at churches and so on. And I was a pastor for a long time, which gave me a weekly opportunity to preach 2-3, sometimes more times every week. And so it was always taking the form of preaching. But the reality is, you know, my preaching, it's been shaped and influenced by my background in a more sort of fundamentalist setting. I've talked to you about that before, but that fundamentalist setting I was in was also very Pentecostal in its style of communication. Not in a lot of the things that would make people think of Pentecostals, but, you know, in the style of revivalism and really provocative and emotive oratory and all that kind of stuff. It was just part of my background. So I can't really preach from the words on a page. Some people can do that really well. I can't. I have to preach from this experience I'm having in the moment. Doesn't mean I don't prepare. I'm always working really hard to prepare. But I'm preparing so that my imagination and my experience in the moment of communicating with that, blah, blah, blah. So lots of, I don't know whether I do it successfully or not, but I want to bring all of the emotive context of connection with my blah, blah, blah. But I really am just teaching. When I'm preaching, I'm teaching. I'm taking the content that I studied and learned and trying to find some format so that I can keep people from falling asleep or walking out on me and leaving having understood what that text said. That's not what everybody should do when they're preaching, and it's not what a lot of people do when they're preaching, but it's what I do, because that's what I want to do. That's what I feel like is the right thing for me to accomplish when I'm standing in a pulpit. Well, those two things go hand in hand, obviously, that I love teaching and that I'm called to preach is as much a testimony to the fact that I just brought myself to my calling as it is to the nature of that calling. It's not required that a person be like that in that calling. My point is that there's something built into me, something I think God built into me, good, bad, or indifferent. This is because the world's fallen, so it could certainly have been turned into something bad. But good, bad, or indifferent, it's just a thing that's built into me that wants to teach. And I love doing that in churches, but I love doing it in a classroom as well. And I don't just mean a Christian classroom. I mean when I have taught in secular settings or in state university settings, I love that. I love those classrooms and the interactions we have. And not just for the evangelistic opportunity it creates, but for the reality of giving ideas and working through those ideas with people who are now gaining them and getting a better perspective on life and all of those other things that go with that, as we'll talk about some of those on the way down through this episode. Anyway, the point is that as I think about higher education and the way we think of it, I'm not sure that I've communicated effectively why that's so important to me. I oversee an institution of Christian higher education. I don't do that passively. It wouldn't be worth it to me to do it for the way people would think of the material rewards that come with it, which I'm blessed to have a job, for instance. I'm grateful for all of that. But it wouldn't be enough for me to do it. I believe in it. And there are so many who doubt and question the value of it. And I think sometimes just don't understand the value of it, that I want to talk about where that value comes from. But so to get there, what I want to do is take a little bit of an odd journey, but really it's not even a whole journey. I just want to create a parallel path as we're talking about this that comes from something I've observed since I was a kid, when I was sitting in the pulpit at the church that my parents took me to before I was even driving on my own, right? So we'd show up for church and we go to Sunday school and we go sit. And I grew up in church, so there was nothing like I'm showing up to this weird phenomenon in the rest of the culture, and we weren't part of it. I grew up in church. I mean, my first memories are this terror of going down the hall at a hospital because I was going to have some teeth pulled or something. I was like 3 years old or 2 years old, whatever I was. It was very young. Right after that, though, I can remember standing in the pews and singing the hymns that were a part of our church experience in Crane, Texas, where I grew up as a little boy. Anyway, the point is, I grew up with that. So as a young man, I was 13, 12, 11, I don't know, in that age range, when I was in elementary school, going into middle school, junior high school, we called it. I sat in church, and often it was this weirdness of looking around and going, it's weird that we do this. It's weird that we all gather in this building and listen to this guy yell at us for 30 minutes. And I loved my pastor. He didn't yell at us. He was really good. So I didn't even think anything critical about what he did at all. Even as a young man, I admired him. My point is that phenomenon is weird. Why do all these people get together and then, okay, we sing some songs. I can sort of make sense of that. You know, you go to a game and you sing the national anthem. So maybe you come in the church and you sing a few songs. And yeah, we want to worship God. So we have this literal desire to just lift up our voices, say something to God. I can justify all that. But then everybody sit down. We're going to let this guy get up and he's just going to yammer at us for the next 30 minutes. And don't you dare do anything to interrupt him, you know, because we don't care about your input. We want this one guy repeatedly for years on end to get up constantly and just tell us what we're supposed to think. And the reality is we're mostly thinking it already, but we need somebody to really ram it into our heads today. So, I mean, you can hear I'm exaggerating as a young person, what I was thinking in my mind, like, this is strange. And still on Sundays when I sit in a church, and I sit in a lot of different churches at different times, it still comes to me. It's like, it's really surprising. And I value all the aspects of why we come together for church. I value the preaching. Obviously, I do it. My whole career is built around that. So I'm not diminishing the value of it, but it's a weird phenomenon, right? It's an odd artifact of history that we do that. And again, let's just pretend that we're not going to go to Hebrews 10:25, or that we're not going to go to Ephesians 4 and then draw the conclusions that we need to about having an edict that says you got to go sit in church on Sunday morning and listen to the preacher, which is not exactly what any of those passages say, by the way. But I could still derive it. I could still arrive at that conclusion in terms of a mandate. But a mandate's not meaningless. You don't have arbitrary mandates. There's something that it does. There's some value to it. We never just say, because God said so. You know, even God says, because it will do this or it will do that. And we don't have a right to question him. I'm not questioning him. My question is to say, so what is it that in our world creates value in that? Now, I can say that from a theological perspective and start having the argument theologically about blah, blah, blah. And some of this will touch on that just by its nature because, you know, reality is all intertwined and you can't separate the theological from the sociological or anything else because reality is just reality. We parse it out because it makes it easier to talk about. Anyway, the point is, I want to look at it not from a theological perspective, not a spiritual perspective, but just a practical human perspective. Why do we do that? Why do we gather together and do stuff like that? And again, it will affect the theological, but if you just think through it, you can gather why we would do it. So it's the same. So why do we give that time on a regular basis to sit and listen to someone present an oratory? And, you know, you show up for a political rally, yeah, once every 4 years, and you listen to somebody give a speech because they want to explain their public policy or they want to drill some theory into your head about why things ought to be this way or that way, and they want you to agree with them. So, you know, persuasively, descriptively, prescriptively, whatever, you listen to somebody every once in a while, that makes sense. People have to tell you things. This is not that. You know, we give ourselves to listening to a person who hasn't just written down something you need to hear. They've developed an oratory. There's an art to the idea of preaching, homiletics, you know, the nature of putting these oratories together and communicating them with some kind of rhetorical expertise and so on. So if I were to look at it historically and say, why did we do this? And then, you know, why does this relic still exist? I could parallel it with the way we treat music. And in particular, I would give the example of parlor music. Meaning, you know, until we had recordings, the only way you could hear music was to make it or to go see someone who could make it. You know, it was all live. And so people learned to play the piano because it didn't matter if you weren't that good at it. At least you were going to hear some music, you know. You were connected with something of beauty and value. Then, and so it makes sense that you would have these moments of parlor music. You know, everybody come into the parlor and so-and-so, Susie's going to play this song and, you know, so-and-so's going to clap their hands and somebody's going to, and they're going to play the, you know, or in bluegrass, you know, or whatever, you know, you're going to get this music. And at least we're going to hear something that adds some beauty and interest to the world and allows us to think about something that's different than, you know, what we're normally doing with our hands and feet during the day. And so I can make sense of music in that world where people are gathering together and doing this thing where you listen to a musician. But with recordings, it's not necessary anymore. In fact, I don't really like going to concerts and things like that because of all the distractions that are around. If I want to listen to music, man, I want to put my headphones on and close my eyes and hear everything that's in the recording. Personal preference. But the point is, I really prefer that. And yet, in a world where we have recordings and we don't need to get together and have concerts or listen to somebody play the piano in our parlor, we have concerts and we get together and I'm my own family and we listen to people play the piano or the guitar and sing a song together. And there's, you know, there are some obvious reasons for that. I mean, there's something admirable in the prowess of the best musicians watching someone do what you know you can't do and most other people in the world can't do. There can be an admiration for that. Most of us don't gather around and watch a sculptor while he's sculpting. But this is performative art, so it's slightly different. I get that. And more, probably more prominently, and this one will come back up on everything we're talking about here, there is something about the shared experience, hearing the same piece of music with someone and interacting with it. And even the performative aspect of it being ours, which is, you know, why the, you know, like almost as terrifying to me as a dentist normally would be. And again, apologies to the dentist. I have a great dentist now. Karaoke, you know, is the same kind of thing. I mean, I just can't even imagine thinking that that would be a positive thing. But a lot of people, you know, go into these places and do karaoke and they think it's fantastic. Or even somebody I do admire. We have a graduate from our college who plays the piano at North Park Mall, and he's out there playing all the time. He's really fantastic, and I love hearing the music. It's interesting that it's more valuable to have a person there playing and everybody walking around, milling around, doing their thing than just playing that same music through the speakers. There's something about the live performance that matters. So I acknowledge that. It's interesting that we maintain that value, that we want to go and see it performed. When the only concert that I went to when I was in, ninth grade, was the Queen concert I've mentioned before. Not advocating for it. I'm just saying I went, you know, in ninth grade. And I remember when they performed, I can't remember, what's it called? Some Rhapsody, Bohemian Rhapsody. When they performed that, you know, which has all these layers to it and all this repetition stuff and whatever, they just walked off the stage. They did not pretend like they were performing it. And so it was their break, I assume. And then they came back and started some other songs after that. And, you know, Freddie Mercury, he could do anything with his voice. So it's not like he couldn't have performed it live. But, I mean, they started the song. They started it with the whatever, a performance. But then when they started into the really complicated parts, they just put down their instruments and walked off the stage and played the rest for us. And we were all still perfectly happy, by the way. We didn't care. No, I was not partaking of the things they were passing around in the concert. I'm just saying it really worked out. My point is, that's kind of, it is still a weird thing. You know, let's go watch this person show off for us, you know, do something for us. But we understand it. We do it out of all those aspects. And I think preaching is in some ways parallel to that in what we're doing. You know, obviously, it's like with parlor music, before there were recordings, you know, we would go and gather and listen. In the same way, you know, before there was widespread literacy, you know, how are you going to get the word? You needed somebody to read it to you, somebody to present it to you. You know, even if you read it yourself, it might be such a struggle that it was nice to have somebody who could read it fluently and present it to you in an organized way and so on. So, you know, in the history of Christianity, it makes sense. Literacy takes a long time to develop into this thing the way we think of it, where you have 90 or 95 or close to 100% literacy in countries. Before that, it makes sense that you would need to go and hear somebody preach this word to you or just read the book to you so that you would understand it. But now we all have a text and we all have study tools. We can figure out what it means ourselves to the extent that we care about it. In fact, I remember traveling in India with friends. You know, I went with this group that did ministry and I was blessed to be with them. And one of the travelers was a person who'd been there many times and was involved in ministry in great depth. And, you know, I did a Bible study. And he loved it. He responded to it well. And, you know, I work hard to study and have things ready when I'm doing something like that. So I did this little devotional type Bible study. And he came to me complaining about his preacher. He's, you know, he patted me on the back and said, "Oh, I love that. That's the best Bible study I've heard," and whatever. People say stuff like that, so I don't take it to heart. But the point is, he said that. And then his complaint was about his preacher. And he said, "I haven't heard in years my preacher do anything that I couldn't have found with my own study tools." Well, it's like, well, that's not the measure of whether what they're preaching is valuable or not. I mean, what did you think, they weren't going to use study tools, or that your study tools are supposed to be inferior? Now, we'll only give you so much here because we want you to have to go to your preacher priest to get the information that you really need. Obviously, it's just silly, but that is something that, you know, it revealed to me what some people think they're trying to get from having a preacher or having someone that stands up there and preaches to them on a weekly basis, which is somebody who's so much smarter or so much better educated that you would never be able to find those things on your own. I think that's a mistake. I don't think that's what we're supposed to think. And I think it would be a real tragedy, and I do see this happen sometimes, if a preacher thought that's what they had to do every week. Oh, I better impress them. I better give them something they've never thought of before. I better make sure they couldn't find it in the text, but only I could find it. You know, it's a weird kind of position that some people end up being pushed into in the ministry because their congregants expect them to be that. It would be a weird cage match-like experience in church if the preacher always had to know the most. And yet, if you look back historically, that was sort of the case. That is, if you went back even just a couple of hundred years ago, the preacher was normally the best educated person in town. And why was it that way? It's not like we were trying to obtain intellectual salvation. Well, if you don't know a lot, then you couldn't come to know Christ as Savior. I mean, a fundamental of the Christian faith is that it's not all that complicated. You know, God made us to do a certain thing. We didn't do it. He's pretty mad, but he still loves us, and so he did something about it and sent his son to die for us, and in his crucifixion pays for our sins, and his resurrection extends life to us in his lordship, and now we follow him and the pattern that he set for us in his life and the reality that he redeemed us from not being able to live the way he commanded us to live. You know, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of intellect to figure that out. You just talk about it and say, start following Jesus, you know? So why is it that the preacher had to be so intellectually engaged and so on? So that's a question I want to talk about in a minute, but it also creates an interesting parallel with what I really want to talk about, which is higher education and why it's so valuable, why it's so important. And before I make the connection or the leap, I do want to go back and say on this, just like with music, there is a reason that you go and listen to the preacher that has nothing to do with the preacher. It has nothing to do with what you're going to hear or not hear. It just has to do with the shared experience, that you're sitting there with other people and being exposed to this word, this reminder of our commands, our message, our commitment as a community, and so on. And in that shared experience, you know, living something you can't live by yourself. A lot of the reason, I think most people, a lot of people go to concerts because you're hearing it with someone else, you know, the same kind of idea. That's also present. I will back up and say, we will get to this, but I'm going to do it inferentially through these things I want to talk about in higher education. So I just want to go back far enough to say, you should not expect the preacher always to be able to say something you've never heard before or create in you something that's never existed before because they have such a grasp of these things that no one else could have. I don't think that's what we're supposed to understand about that person standing at the front and reminding us of the commandment to be a follower of Christ. I think there is partially built into it the nature of our following Christ, that we are followers. We are not the leader. We are the one who follows Christ. And so it becomes particularly important, so I'm going to say this in two steps. Number one, that, you know, when the preacher gets up to preach, that we're reminded that there is someone who gave us commandments. There is someone we were committed to follow, and he sort of steps into that role. And in the way the Catholic Church talks about it as a vicar, you know, someone who's standing in their place, literally, vicariously, representing Christ, they actually do. And so, again, I'm not adopting Catholicism as a whole. I'll talk more about that word in a minute and how we shy away from it or afraid of the word Catholicism for some reason. And I know a lot of the reasons people are afraid of it, but my point is, I'll come back to that in a minute. You know, there is that role of standing in there, and like Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, be followers of me, even as I also am of Christ. There's that side of it, and then there's the really imperative side of it for preachers, for the pastor, elder, bishop in a congregation to hear what Peter says in 1 Peter 5, and understand how critically important it is that he not take that role as if he is Jesus, as if he has taken the Lord's place, but is instead an under-shepherd, you know, a servant under the one who, even in taking his lordship and demonstrating it to us, demonstrated it by himself becoming a servant, giving us the mandate to wash one another's feet. And so it becomes particularly important that preachers not occupy that role because of their celebrity, because of their power, because of their leadership skills, but because they have become such a committed serving follower of Jesus, that we can follow Jesus better if we see that person following Jesus in that same way. And if you read it in Hebrews 13, that's exactly what's being communicated. You know, follow those who are giving you, obey those who have the rule over you. But that rule is a double entendre. It's not just rule like authority, it's rule like standard. They set the standard for you, and you only follow them considering the end of their lifestyle, considering the end of their own obedience to Christ. So it becomes particularly important for that reason too. So in that sense, I needed to insert the little theological thing that says it makes sense that we have someone who stands up and makes these declarations to us and represents the truth of Scripture, but with a life that's actually living it out, and then says, and this is what it's like. But it's not because they are inherently more intellectual than those who are in the pew. They may be more educated. They may not be. There are people, there are always going to be people who are listening who are as well educated or more educated than the person who's actually speaking in the pulpit. That's just always going to be the case, because there are areas where we all know more things than somebody else, and we all have a variety of different inputs into the body that are important. But that person standing up there is a provocation for us to see one example of a life that's faithful and that gives us the opportunity to be a better follower of Christ. And so in that one sense, I just wanted to say up front, obviously that's where this goes, but it goes there for a reason that I think is more nuanced, more complex than simply having someone. I mean, we could just rotate that. We'll just put somebody up there and let them speak. You know, why is it that we need to hear from somebody like this? And I think it's interestingly, and I don't know if it's coincidentally or if it's somehow inherently or intrinsically related. I can understand it either way. I'm just not sure which it is. it's very similar to what goes on in higher education. Why we would give ourselves to an institution and go and learn things from professors, for instance, instead of just saying, look, I'm just going to stay home, do my own Bible study today, for instance, in the theological context. Or, hey, yeah, I'm just checking out a bunch of books, and that's going to be my education. That's going to be my higher education. I think there's a reason that higher education is valuable, but it's just as odd an artifact in our culture as Sunday morning preaching. And really, I mean in situ higher education. Come to campus, live in our dormitory, which, again, I oversee an institution of Christian higher education, and we built a dorm a few years ago, but the very generous donation of Mary Stanton, who just, you know, because God did something in her, made it possible for us to build that dorm. And it's, you know, it's transformed our campus, but we were already committed to educating locally, bringing students to Old East Dallas and learning the intellectual side and the practical side of what it means to serve Christ and to live out the calling that we have on our lives. Anyway, the point is that kind of education where you go to a campus and you live in a dorm or, you know, nearby the campus and you give yourself to the classes by walking to the classroom and sitting down with all the other students and the professor walks in and locks the door and doesn't let the late people in, which is not what I do. But anyway, the point is that kind of experience in the classroom, that's a little odd. I mean, there are other options for how we could be gaining expertise and learning things now that you would think would have ruled that out of existence. Just the internet and artificial intelligence, right? I mean, I want to know something. Oh, I need to have a professor. No, just Google it. You know, just ask Google and you can figure it out, right? So, and if you go beyond that, beyond just the internet, there's AI itself and what it's doing now. So you just go to AI and ask however complicated a question you want and see what you get. Or you know, just looking on the internet, not just Google it, but go to Google Books. You want to read Principia Mathematica? All right, we've got it. Alfred North Whitehead, the answer to all the explanation of why the axioms in math are what they are and what you should know about formal logic and so on. Just go look it up. Google Books. Read it. Read the whole thing. It's all there. Project Gutenberg. Download whatever public domain text you want to and spend all the time you want learning and reading and growing intellectually. It's all available on the internet. Why are we going to campuses? Why are we spending millions of dollars to go to campuses and, you know, spend 4 years of the best years of our lives? Please. Anyway, the point is what we think of as the best years of our lives on a college campus. I mean, you get just, you know, open up ChatGPT and ask it a complicated question, or Gemini or Copilot or Rufus or Apple Intelligence or whatever you want for your AI engine. Or if you're on a lower level, ask Alexa or Google or Siri or Bixby or whoever it is you talk to, you know, when other people aren't around for you to talk to. If you can go there, why are we going to campus? And yet, campus life persists, man. And admittedly, and this is not a reluctant admittance, but it's the same thing we were talking about with music, same thing we were talking about preaching. There is a social aspect of it. I know that. That's not what I'm talking about today, but there is a social aspect to it. Like the debate over online education, well, that's how you make your money, you know, just put all your classes online and then it's just a cash cow, you know, coming in. That's how people think of it. That doesn't change the fact that parents and students are on waiting lists to pay often tens of thousands of dollars per year, sometimes per semester, to get into dorms in colleges all over the country. And I mean waiting lists. Like, I don't know if my student's going to be able to get in and into that dorm room and be able to pay those $50,000 for the next two semesters. There's something really desirable about being on a college campus. And I get it. The way a lot of people talk about it, it's just that 4 years of wild party life and experience. You know, I've heard people who didn't get a college education or a university education lament it solely because they didn't get the experience of those 4 years being around other college students and living the college life. You know, it's all about, and again, I don't even just mean this in the drunken stupor of Animal House or something. That's my age coming out there. But anyway, the point is, I don't even mean it in those terms. I just mean, you know, oh, you know, we got the fraternity going and we got to go to the ball games and, you know, all that stuff that goes with it. But if that were it, if that's all there were to it, then majors wouldn't matter. Classes would still be online. Hey, come to the campus, live in the dorm, have your parties, and then get up in the morning and get online and take your classes. Now, I know there's some of that going on, but if you did that very much, you know, most people are just not going to pay the extra money to have their student on campus just so they can have that lifestyle. Some do, and that's a different thing. But most are not going to do that. And that, from my perspective, is certainly not the question that we're trying to answer. The question we're answering from my side of the issue, and I'm acknowledging this is a personal discussion today. It's my understanding of how this all works out. I oversee not just an institution of Christian higher education, but a missional institution. We are committed to Christianity, and there are a lot of schools that are committed to that, and we're grateful for all of them. But we're also committed to higher education's value. And again, we're not unique in this. There are a ton of schools that are committed to higher education's value. So I'm not trying to lord it over everybody else and say, we're the only school like this. I'm just talking about the values that we do have. We're committed to that. And we're coming to it. We didn't come to it and say, well, let's do a market survey and see if anybody wants to learn anything about Christianity. We didn't start out that way and say, oh, okay, well, I guess we'll be a Christian school. We started out with a commitment to Christianity, same way with higher education. We didn't do a big survey back in 1970 and say, you know, I wonder if anybody wants higher education. We said, we value what higher education gives people, and we value it from a Christian context. And so we want to provide Christian higher education in the thing that we're doing. What is it? This is what I'm talking about and what I want to get to. What is it that makes higher education so valuable? And I get, and this is where we'll start next time. I get we're going to break this in half. I think what almost everyone, I'm not going to say it about everyone, what most people in my world immediately think of when they think of the value of higher education is economic value. That's it. I mean, I remember hearing in a political campaign a few years ago, right at the beginning of the campaign, well, I'm going to make it so every single degree that's offered in the state where this person was running for governor, every single degree offered at one of our public institutions, we can point directly to the exact amount of money that students are able to make because they got that degree instead of not having that degree. And if they can't justify it, we're going to eliminate it. If they can't show where the economic value is, we're going to eliminate that. Now, that sounds very pragmatic, and because it's pragmatic, it sounds very appealing to voters. Like, ah, we're going to quit doing this fluff stuff. We're not going to have any more underwater basket weaving classes. We're only going to do the stuff that earns money and makes it worthwhile to the economy that we have right now. But to somebody who's really committed to higher education, it's a terrifying utterance. And not because, oh, no, what if they eliminate my discipline? But because it's evidence that they do not understand the value, the real value that higher education has, not just trade school. And trade school is incredibly important and valuable in its own right. But it's not the same as higher education as higher education. And so why, you know, what is it that gives it that value? What is it that makes it what it is? And I think it's inherently parallel, not just coincidentally parallel. Inherently parallel to what makes it so important for us to gather together in that weird artifact of Sunday morning worship that we have in our culture right now. And I say weird artifact not because we're not just obeying the command that's in Scripture. We're doing something that's been passed down from generation to generation for now millennia and still doing it with aplomb. What on earth is going on there? We'll talk more about that next week.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.